or today requires some kind of sweeping gesture, because there's a lot of today. So first I want to talk about how to describe thermal equilibrium holographically, which I think you all already know the punchline there, but I want to explain how to do it in detail. And then I want to talk about perturbations of thermal equilibrium of some class of systems that have a holographic dual. This I guess is usually called hydrodynamics. I want to talk about one very particular aspect of hydrodynamics, namely the calculation of the viscosity of such a fluid. And then I want to talk about how to turn on a finite number density in such a system, where you could ask me number of what, and this is a hard question. Finite number density of some number of something. We'll see that this is a very interesting thing. And then I'm going to make some sort of general remarks about what we've learned about how to apply holographic duality to physics, based on what we've seen so far. And then these are maybe cautionary remarks. And then I'm going to talk about one particular example of an attempt to apply holographic duality to learn something about physics, which will be the subject of the rest of the discussion, which is attempts to understand non-Fermi liquids holographically. So finite temperature. So by the way, when I say finite, this is a practice among some part of the population of humans. I mean not zero and not infinity. Not everybody agrees about this use of the word finite, but anyway, I mean not zero. So far I've been talking almost exclusively about anti-de-Sitter space, right? Which is the space-time geometry that has this big symmetry group, which includes scale invariants, right? It includes all of the conformal symmetry of a relativistic field theory in one fewer dimension. And as I've tried to convince you, the geometry of the space-time, away from the boundary, away from this ultraviolet boundary, is saying something not just about which field theory we're studying, but also about which state it's in, right? Namely, what sources we added to the action, how we perturbed it, and also how it responded to that perturbation. And so anti-de-Sitter space is scale invariant. And this is the statement that it describes a scale invariant field theory, a scale invariant field theory in a scale invariant state. So it's a system whose Hamiltonian doesn't have any scale in it, and also the state that we're studying it in doesn't have any scale in it, which basically means the vacuum. I think that probably uniquely specifies it to be the vacuum of the CFT, the conformally invariant vacuum. But of course, given some field theory, there are many interesting states to study it in. For example, it's interesting to study relevant perturbations of that theory. It's interesting, for example, to put the thing at finite temperature. So this was a particular solution of the equations of motion of some class of gravity systems, but if we include some kind of scale in the problem, the saddle point for some other ensemble in which we can put the CFT that has a scale. So there's some label on the ensemble, which is a scale, like, say, the temperature is a scale that appears in the thermal ensemble, this is a geometry which approaches ADS. Let's say which approaches ADS as you approach the boundary, right? So this is saying at short distances, a distance is much smaller than this, the length scale associated with this thing, it returns to being ADS. If you probe it at very high energies, it doesn't care that you turned on a temperature. But then at longer wavelengths, you can see that you introduce some kind of scale. And a general solution that preserves rotation invariance, but doesn't necessarily preserve Poincaré invariance, is of this form, a general such solution. Minus f of z So the fact that this thing depends on z means that it won't necessarily be scale invariant. Z squared, sorry. This is a t. The fact that the metric only depends on dx vector squared is the statement that it preserves rotation invariant. Okay, and so this f of z, okay, the fact that I put the same function here and here, you probably couldn't have guessed on general grounds. It's a actually, if you like, you could make it so by a coordinate choice, by redefining the coordinate z. But trust me that the nice solution is of this form, with the same function here and here. So this function is called the emblackening factor. This is the official name that everybody agrees about, really. This is so because, you see, if this thing has a zero, if it vanishes anywhere as a function of z, then such a locus has a chance to be in the event horizon of a black hole. Because, you see, time slows down and these radial lengths are extended. It's in fact, very similar to the event horizon of the familiar Schwarzschild black hole. And recall that the case when this is 1 is just the Poincaré, is just the ADS metric that we've been talking about. I claim that with the following choice of f, the following choice of this function f, this metric satisfies the same equations of motion as the ADS metric satisfies. So if I pick this equals 1 minus z over zh to the d, where zh is a dimensionful parameter appearing in the solution, not appearing in the action, this solves the same equation of motion, solves the same gravity equations of motion as anti-de-Sitter space. It approaches ADS near z goes to 0, because you see as z goes to 0, you can forget about this term, this positive power of z, and it just f goes to 1, that's ADS. And so this is another solution with the same leading asymptotics, and it has a horizon. It has really, honestly, a black hole horizon at z equals zh, where the emblackening factor has a zero. And in particular, it has a linear zero. So f of z near z goes to zh is of the form some number whose name I was going to remember. I think it's kappa, z minus zh. Some numerical coefficient which depends on zh times z minus zh. This depends on zh and the number of dimensions. And I think if I got the factors right, this is the same as the surface gravity. So I'm emphasizing here that this emblackening factor has a linear zero, a first order zero, just the generic kind of zero, near the horizon. And in fact, this locus is a horizon. Excuse me. I'm falling through the horizon of the table. This is a horizon in the sense that if we look at this geometry, let's draw. I'm going to draw z going to the left because I always picture the boundary on the right. I'm sorry. So here's the boundary of ADS. Z equals 0. Boundary of ADS. Here's z equals zh. And this is a space-time diagram where time goes this way. It's not a Penrose diagram. So I'm just drawing time and z. And this z equals zh is a horizon in the sense that if you study null geodesics in this space-time, the ones over here, you know, if you start a null geodesic over here, it can reach the boundary. If you start it over here, it can reach the boundary. If you start it here, it skims just along the horizon. If you start it on the horizon, it stays on the horizon. And if you start it over here, it can never escape. So just by following null geodesics, you can see that nothing that happens in here can ever influence anything that happens at the boundary. So it really is a horizon in the like official relativist sense of the word. So far this is just statements about the geometry of the ADS black hole, which I think you've all thought about a little bit already. These things, by the way, are meant to be cartoons of null geodesics. Because I didn't say that clearly. But then I think you all know that
the physics of horizons, at least of horizons like this, which where there's a
first order zero, which, by the way, this is called a Rindler horizon. And I realize that it's the physics of Rindler horizons that I'm talking about here. Whereas there's this kind of first order zero is that Rindler horizons describe thermally mixed states. And the reason for this is, at least one way to see this, is that if we demand that this geometry be smooth also as a function of Euclidean time, as a function of the analytically continued time variable, then this condition of Euclidean regularity, just like how it specified that we had to pick Bessel K rather than Bessel I in solving the scalar wave equation in ADS, it demands that the Euclidean time, tau, which is minus it, it demands that we identify tau with itself plus some shift, which is related to this parameter kappa. And then periodic Euclidean time means finite temperature, where this parameter here is 1 over the temperature. And so comparing, if you Taylor expand this function near z equals zh, you'll see that, which I think you've probably already done, is you see that the temperature is it's 1 over pi zh. Okay, so this is the temperature of something. It's the temperature of the Hawking radiation that comes out of the black hole. It's the temperature of somebody in thermal equilibrium. And in the case of black holes in, say, flat space, that somebody is a mystery, right? It's a interesting open question in theoretical physics to figure out who that somebody is. But here we know very well what the answer is, namely that this black hole describes the thermal equilibrium of the dual field theory. And the black hole with this temperature describes the field theory at that temperature. And I say that, and so we can see that based on just things we've already said, because the bulk metric, as we approach z equals zero, you could imagine studying some more general class of metrics, where more generally, as z goes to zero, the metric can look something like this. So more generally, there could be some complicated, fancy metric on the space-time coordinates. You know, suppose you had a solution like this. It's still asymptotically ADS in the sense that the metric is this kind of warp factor times some metric, some sort of Minkowskian metric on R3, 1. A geometry of this form is dual, describes some state of a field theory on a spacetime with this metric. Right, so this is part of the dictionary, right? I said that the operator in the field theory, which is the stress tensor, corresponds to the perturbations of the metric in the bulk. Right? The boundary value of the metric in the bulk is what determines what perturbation we make to the stress tensor of the field theory. The stress tensor of the field theory is the thing that couples to the background metric that the field theory is living on. It's the response of the field theory to a change in the background metric. And so this is the sort of nonlinear version of that statement, that if we put the field theory on something, some spacetime whose metric is this, then we want to study bulk geometries, which asymptote to something of this form. And this includes not just saying that the metric can depend on space and time in this way, but it also includes things about the topology of that space-time that you're putting the field theory on. So this is including the topology of the space in which we put the quantum field theory. And so here I'm saying that the Euclidean time of the bulk space-time is periodic. It's periodic with this period. And that's true even at the boundary. And so that's, the Euclidean time is one of these coordinates. And so the statement that the Euclidean time of the bulk spacetime is periodic by this statement implies that the Euclidean time of the field theory that we're studying is periodic. So the Euclidean time of the field theory also satisfies exactly the same periodicity. which says this is the temperature of the field theory. Okay. So this describes, so that is to say that the static black hole, static ADS black hole, is a saddle point. One second, let me just say the dramatic final sentence. Is the saddle point of this bulk field theory, which describes thermal equilibrium of the dual CFT. Okay, yes, please. Here. Oh, it's not an approximation. So sorry. Okay, so I introduced this variable kappa in this statement. So I was a little lazy here. So this is just Taylor expanding the function f of z around the point z equals zh where it has a zero. And so this kappa is the slope of f at that point, so that you can figure it out from that. You're going to make me do it, aren't you? It's something like d over zh to the d. Right? Minus, maybe. Yeah, there's the sign. It's a little confusing. So z is less than z-ish. Yes. Okay, good. That fixes the sign. So the space-time we're studying is, this is z equals 0, and this is z equals z-ish, so you know, we're approaching the horizon from smaller values of z. Right, so kappa is some function of ZH that you can figure out, and if you figure it out, you can convince yourself that okay. So we said 2 pi over kappa is 1 over t, and then I'm just solving for t. Yeah. So do you agree with this statement? I mean, is this okay that so there's Euclidean regularity demands that the Euclidean time is periodic, and with some particular period. And then we identified that period with 1 over the temperature. Is that part okay? Right, I mean, that's what you mean by the thermal ensemble is trace e to the minus beta h. Right? And that says that you know you start at one Euclidean time, you propagate in Euclidean time by an amount beta. Right, you propagate in Euclidean time by an amount beta, and then you identify. Right, that's what trace means. And then you agree that beta is 1 over t. Right, so this thing is equal to beta is equal to 1 over t. Right, so that's why this is the case. Okay. So let me make some more comments, which I hopefully will clarify this some more. So once you believe this. Then you should also believe that the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, so this BH stands for either Bekenstein-Hawking or black hole, it's very convenient, is the entropy, the thermal entropy of the field theory of the CFT. And so let's compute it. So it's in Einstein gravity, that's the area of the horizon over G Newton, which that's 1 over G Newton times the area of the horizon is, well, it's an integral over z equals zh. Right? The horizon is z equals zh. And it's a fixed time. Right? The horizon is it's something, and if I pick some particular time, there's a horizon there, here somewhere. And I'm suppressing the spatial dimensions in that picture. And so there's some square root of g d minus 1x. This is integral over just the spatial dimensions, right, of the field theory, and then there's an important factor of square root of g, so that's 1 over g Newton times the square root of g gives L over zh to the d minus 1. From just plugging in that metric, the factors of the emblackening factor cancel. They weren't in there because we're at fixed z and fixed t, so it's just it's the only thing that matters is the coefficient of the spatial directions. And so this is, but then we have to integrate over those spatial directions. So let me put a vector of v. This v is the volume of space. which, you know, maybe that's infinite, but it's useful to regulate it and give it a name. And so, and so I've written this in terms of ZH. We can use our formula for the temperature to rewrite this in terms of the temperature. And this is LADS to the D minus 1. Here I'm okay. Yes, that's LADS over 4 G Newton, the volume. Okay, so I'm just writing the same thing again. This is exactly the same formula. I don't need to write it again. So now I'm going to use two things. I'm going to use T is 1 over pi ZH, and I'm going to use L ADS to the D minus 1 over G Newton is equal to something like N squared. So this was a formula that we derived by counting degrees of freedom. We also derived it by solving the equations of motion for D3 brains. And if we solved those equations of motion more carefully in the case of D3 brains, we could have figured out the numerical factors in front, which are relevant for the case where the field theory is the N equals 4 superangles. And so I'll write the numerical factors for that case, which is there's a 2 pi, actually. L squared over 4 G Newton is equal to N squared over 2 pi. So this is for the particular case of N equals 4 superangles is where that 2 pi is actually true. Okay? So using these two facts, we can rewrite this purely in terms of field theory quantities. Right? So this, you know, this I'm claiming that this is supposed to be the thermal entropy of the CFT. And if we do that, it's pi squared over 2 N squared volume of space T to the D minus 1. Okay, so now nobody's going to be surprised by the fact that the entropy is extensive, right? The entropy of this field theory is proportional to the volume. That's a good thing. And also, the entropy is dimensionless, right? Entropy is a dimensionless quantity. It's log of some number. And so in order for this whole thing to be dimensionless, n is dimensionless, pi is dimensionless, 2 is dimensionless, the only scale in the problem is the temperature. And so the power of temperature here is completely fixed by dimensional analysis already. And so this result is not surprising at all. And really, the only thing we're calculating is the coefficient. Also, the fact that the entropy is proportional to the number of degrees of freedom per point is also not surprising, right? The fact that there's this n squared here. And so really, the only thing that you could have been at all surprised about is the pi squared over 2, which it's hard to have expectations about. I guess it's a little more useful to it will be more useful to write the entropy density, which I'll denote by little s, which is big S over V, and so which, if you like, is the area density of the black hole over 4 G Newton. I wrote this almost totally so that I could say the word area density, and so that's just this pi squared over 2 n squared t to the d minus 1. Okay, This was a calculation that sort of had to work. We're going to use it as a check in a minute. So let me write the most important formula again, which is very instructive for thinking about this result. So here's how to think about this. So the CFT partition function at finite temperature, this, you know, trace e to the minus beta h of the CFT, it's equal to this, you know, path integral of quantum gravity with ADS boundary conditions. We don't really know what that is, but we can do it by saddle point in this limit, in the large n limit. This integral is doable by saddle point, and the answer is e to the minus s, where this is the Euclidean action of the bulk theory, evaluated on some solution of the equations of motion, which satisfy, ADS boundary conditions with the right. So let's say g is asymptotically ADS. G is the metric asymptotically ADS. And has periodic Euclidean time with temperature T. All right, so this is, I mean, this is again just this basic quantitative statement of the Adiacici correspondence. But I'm saying that we know what this G is. I just erased it. And we know what the action is, and so we can, you know, this has all the information about the thermal physics of the CFD at large N and at strong coupling. And so, you know, this by definition is equal to e to the minus beta times the free energy. So this is just, over here, this is just statements about thermal physics, about statistical mechanics that you all know. And, you know, this is the key mysterious new relation. And so, okay. And so to evaluate the free energy, we just have to plug our metric into the bulk action. And so that sounds very simple, right? You have the solution of the equations of motion. You know what the action is. You can plug it in. You evaluate it. You get the free energy. It's a little bit, there are a few subtleties that are worth mentioning. And so I think I'll spend a few minutes mentioning them. I want to talk about plugging into here. So this bulk action, as a function of some general metric, well, it's something like 1 over 16 pi g Newton integral over the bulk spacetime, square root of g Ricci scalar. There's a cosmological constant, which is related to the ADS radius in this way. So this is the whole bulk action. But then, there's an important extra ingredient, which I have to say, which is that in order to have a well-posed equations of motion in this gravity theory in ADS, which ADS has a boundary, it's important to add certain boundary terms to this action. So some of these terms are like the ones that I mentioned about holographic renormalization for removing these annoying contact terms in our correlators, but there's one of them that has a different role, which is this thing called the Gibbons-Hawking term. Have you heard about the Gibbons-Hawking term? Yeah? You've heard about it. She did. Okay. Okay, so I'll just say a few words about it. So this thing here is called the Gibbons-Hawking term, and this gamma is the boundary metric. In case I didn't write it recently, what I mean by that gamma is I write the bulk metric in coordinates like this, and then I guess it's the thing I call. Actually, you know what? It's this thing. Where did it go? It's this thing. Whatever it is that's there is what I mean by gamma. So it includes factors of z and stuff. This theta is the extrinsic curvature of the boundary. Extrinsic curvature scalar of the boundary, which is gamma mu nu times the sort of gradient of, it's the gradient of this normal vector, where this n is a unit normal, unit outward normal to the boundary surface at z equals epsilon. So notice I'm including this cutoff, this cutoff at the boundary. And so more explicitly, this extrinsic curvature is the z component of this normal vector over 2 gamma mu nu z derivative of gamma mu nu. Okay, so this is a very explicit expression for the extrinsic curvature. And the role of this Gibbons-Hawking term, in case so here's the reason that it's a good idea to have this Gibbons-Hawking term, is that if we didn't add it, if we didn't have this term here, when we look at the equations of motion for gravity in this space-time, the variation of this Einstein-Hilbert action with respect to the metric is something of this form. There's bulk terms, which are, you know, this is just things proportional to the Einstein equation. And then there's an extra term, which is an integral over the boundary of something like this. Normal derivative dot d of the variation of the boundary metric, contracted with the boundary metric. And notice that This is something which if I pick something like a Dirichlet condition on the metric, if I demand that my metric approach something like this, some particular fixed boundary metric at the boundary, like I've been saying I want to do, you know, I want to describe quantum field theory on some particular boundary metric, then under a general variation with those boundary conditions, this thing will not be zero. And so this action is not consistent with the boundary conditions we were trying to impose. And so you know the reason being that there are derivatives, normal derivatives, acting on this thing, which isn't necessarily zero with those boundary conditions. And so the role of the Gibbons Hawking term is to cancel these terms in the variation. The variation of the Gibbons Hawking term cancels this term. That's the point of it, and that's what determines the coefficient to be -2. Okay. So because we want the variation of the action to vanish with an arbitrary choice of delta gamma mu nu equals 0 at the boundary. Okay. So that's the role of the Gibbons-Hawking term. And I'm mentioning it because it plays, it gives most of the answer for the free energy when you plug in the solution. And then finally, so this is the Gibbons-Hawking term, which notice is something that we might call extrinsic. This extrinsic is the same as this extrinsic, in the sense that it depends on derivatives of the, you know, there's this normal derivative, there's a z derivative. It depends on derivatives of the fields at the boundary. Whereas these things here are some intrinsic local counterterms. And the fact that they're intrinsic counterterms means that they don't have any effect on what boundary conditions we impose in the fields. And all they do is change the value of the Onshell action. And so this, you know, for example, this thing is just a constant. And then there can be other terms depending on intrinsic curvatures of the boundary, if there is one. Okay. Okay, so then I claim that if you evaluate that quantity with a choice of C naught so that you get a finite answer, there are fancier ways to pretend to choose C naught. But really what you're doing is choosing C naught so that you get a finite answer. The answer you get for the free energy is minus F over V is O. Okay, I'm gonna write it for the case of the n equals 4 theory. So the n equals 4 appears in the fact that the boundary theory is going to be 3 plus 1 dimensional, and it's going to determine the factors of pi. So that's the only role that it's going to play. So that means V equals 3 plus 1 and this relation. So that's what I mean when I say I'm picking n equals 4. And so with that choice, it's L squared over 16 pi g Newton 1 over z h to the fourth is pi squared over 8 n squared 2 to the fourth. Okay, so again, the power of t is determined by dimensional analysis. The free energy is an energy. So this free energy per volume has to be an energy density, which in 3 plus 1 dimensions has to go like energy to the fourth. And so the only scale is the temperature. It has to go like 2 to the fourth. The fact that the number of degrees of freedom appears here isn't too surprising. And then the factor of pi is particular to this case. Okay. All right, let me make some comments. So the first comment is there's a very nice check of this answer. So there are a few interesting checks. So the first check is that if you compute the entropy from this quantity by the first law of thermodynamics demands that it's related to the temperature derivative of the free energy. So this is just thermodynamics. So this is basically a self-consistency condition on the idea that this is describing thermal equilibrium of something. Taking a derivative of this, you have to get the entropy. And so a check on this calculation is that that gives the same answer as this. And in fact, this is the case. And notice that this is actually a pretty strong check of this answer, because you see, this thing we calculated just using facts about the geometry near the horizon, right? So we only had to evaluate stuff at z equals zh. So this is just at the horizon. Whereas this thing, this free energy, was involved really all of the spacetime. So this was some integral over the whole spacetime. Right, this integral over all of spacetime. And so this is it's actually a rather strong check that something consistent is happening. Okay, and so this is really a check of the first law of thermodynamics. The second check is if you can get the specific heat of this black hole, say the specific heat at fixed volume, you may know that the specific heat of black holes in asymptotically flat space is negative, right? As they, if you try to increase their, if you, the energy and the temperature go in opposite directions, right? A bigger black hole has a lower temperature. This is related to the fact that they evaporate into states at asymptotic infinity. And so if I told you that the thermodynamics of a black hole is the same as the thermodynamics of an ordinary quantum field theory, you may have some feeling like, you know, something might be wrong because, well, don't black holes have negative specific heat? But, you know, an ordinary quantum field theory is just an ordinary thing, which if you heat it up, but you have to put energy in to heat it up, and, you know, it doesn't explode. And so the fact that this thing is positive is a very nice consistency check on the statement, and it's extremely important difference between black holes in anti-de Sitter space and black holes in flat space. Black holes in anti-de Sitter space don't evaporate. And that's basically because anti-de Sitter space is like a box. There's nowhere for them, no states far away for them to evaporate to. When they emit radiation, it bounces off the boundary and comes back. And so they're sort of in equilibrium with their own thermal radiation, which is stuck in the gravitational well of anti-de Sitter space. So ADS black holes are different. So that's good. Okay, and then finally there's one more one more very important general statement, which is that the uniqueness theorems for stationary black holes, this I guess which is usually called no-Hare theorems. So this is a very important general consistency condition for this idea. The fact that stationary black holes are labeled by very few parameters, very few macroscopic variables that you can keep track of, like the temperature or their energy, or if they have a charge, they can have a charge, or their angular momentum. This fact maps to the fact that in the equilibrium thermodynamics, there's only so many macroscopic state variables. So this is, you know, this is one of these sort of trivial statements that it's very important to emphasize because, you know, this a priori didn't have to work this way. What's up? What is n equals 4? I'm sorry, it's a particular maximally supersymmetric field theory in 3+1 dimensions.
So it's n equals 4.
Superangles, yeah. I'm sorry, people talk about this theory so much that it's, you know, you get so tired of saying the whole name. Yeah, so what I was saying, what I mean by that is the only thing that this information conveys is that I'm specifying to 3+1 dimensions, to d equals 4, and the factors of pi here that appear in this relationship between the bulk Newton constant and the number of degrees of freedom per point are special to that case. If, for example, I were saying something about the theory of D3 brains probing the conifold, there would be some other factors of pi here. Yeah, this is a calligraphic n. It's yeah.
So,
Yeah, it's this n. Yeah, number of degrees of freedom per point is n squared. Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah, sorry, I got to work on that font. okay, so this is an important general point about this idea that black holes in some holographic spacetime can describe thermal equilibrium, equilibrium thermodynamics of ordinary systems. It's important that you don't have to label them by a zillion parameters. Rather, that the something about the gravity theory coarse grains over those parameters for you. Okay, and then finally, so returning to the specific case of the n equals 4 theory, the n equals 4 theory is a really weird theory where the coupling constant is really a parameter, and you can really imagine varying it between weak coupling and strong coupling in some sort of adiabatic way. And so it's possible to compare the answer that you get as a function of the Tiff coupling in this theory for the free energy, which, let's write the free energy over the volume n squared t. Okay, let me write the free energy divided by the lambda equals infinity answer. No. Let's write the free energy divided by the lambda equals 0 answer. Okay, so when lambda equals 0, this is 1. Right, so this is the free energy of n equals 4 Supra-Ingalls theory as zero coupling is something you can all imagine computing. Right, it's more or less just a count of the degrees of freedom. Right, the particles don't interact. The particles appearing in the Lagrangian are exactly the ones that appear in the thermal ensemble. Just equilibrium quantum field theory. How it got in equilibrium in the first place is a question that you don't have to ask here. But then the calculation that we've just done is a statement about lambda equals infinity. And in fact, the conclusion is that this number, the value of this thing at lambda equals infinity, is 3/4 of this number. So, right, so this does something like this. You can also compute the answer perturbatively in lambda. And in fact, you can also compute the corrections to this answer in 1 over lambda at strong coupling. And all of the information that we have about this is consistent with the idea that this just sort of smoothly interpolates from between 1 at weak coupling and 3/4 of that at strong coupling. So even though we're varying this coupling between, this free quarks and gluons kind of description here, no quarks, free gluons and adjoint scalars here, and gluinos, and very strongly interacting such things that are better described by strings propagating into De Sitter space, the answer for the free energy only changes by a factor of 3/4. So this is to say that thermodynamics isn't very sensitive to strong coupling. Something that's worth noticing is actually a very similar result obtains in quantum chromodynamics in real QCD. You can do some similar calculation where you compute the free energy, for example, at high temperatures, where the thing is just compute it in the free theory. Just turn off the interactions. In free QCD, the answer, so you normalize it, so the answer is 1. People are now able to do very extensive lattice calculations where they can calculate they can study QCD at finite temperature in the regime where the coupling is strong, and say just a little bit above the deconfinement transition. And I forget what the current answer is, but now it's let's just say a T of order the lambda QCD where it's very strongly coupled. I think the last I heard it's something like 80%. So that is to say, also in real QCD, the difference between free quarks and gluons and strongly interacting quarks and gluons is not such a big difference either. Okay. So that is to say, the thermodynamics is not such a great thing to study if you're interested in trying to distinguish between weakly coupled theories and strongly coupled theories. Okay. Okay. I guess there's one class of observables that's worth mentioning here, which is that so far the thermodynamic observables that we computed are the entropy, which we computed by some horizon integral, and the free energy, which we computed by computing this on-shell action. Actually, we can compute all of the thermodynamic variables by explicitly computing the expectation for the quantum field theory stress tensor. And I think you all know how to do this already, because the thing you should do is just vary the metric on which the field theory is living and study the linear response to that variation. And so this is 2 over square root of gamma, the variation of the on-shell action with respect to this, with this gamma. So this is, you know, this is a perturbation. Perturb the boundary conditions of the metric. This is just an application of this general formalism for, you know, if I want to compute a correlation function, so in particular a one-point function of some operator in the field theory, I compute the on-shell action of the bulk theory and vary it with respect to the boundary value of the corresponding field. So this is just a specification of this general formula for computing expectation values. But this tmu nu is the field theory stress tensor. And in particular, in thermal equilibrium, we think of this component of the stress tensor as the energy density, and these components of the stress tensor as the pressure. This P is for pressure. And yes, please. Boundary condition. Condition. Yeah, perturb the boundary condition of the metric. Sorry. I was saying lots and lots of words to explain this equation, which if you stare at it, you'll see that it's just a special case of this equation we've been using all the time, right? It's really just this same statement again, right? That the field theory partition function, which I can think of as, you know, if I knew it as a function of arbitrary boundary conditions, is a generating function of all the correlators of all the operators, and it's equal to this on-shell action, right? And so taking the log here pulls down the action, and then varying that with respect to the boundary conditions gives correlation functions of the corresponding operators. Good. Right, and so this particular operator is interesting because, you know, this component is the energy density and these components are the pressure. The fact that they're all equal is a consequence of rotation invariance. And if you compute them in this theory, in this black hole, just by doing this operation, it's not too hard. You can convince yourself that the energy density is d times the pressure, or O is it? I think it must be d minus 1, huh? D minus 1 times the pressure, which for the n equals 4 theory, this is a 3. And which this, by the way, is the statement that the stress tensor is traceless. The expectation value of the stress tensor in a CFT is traceless. And so in particular, it's like, well, this is traceless, and so its expectation value is also traceless. Right? So this is the statement of scale invariance. Yeah? It's okay? Yeah. So this is another check. Okay. Why is it the statement of scale invariance? Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this fact is probably, you've probably heard about this in detail in the two-dimensional context, where, you know, you're used to the idea that in two dimensions the stress tensor is holomorphic if it's a CFT. And, you know, that's actually the same statement in some funny coordinates. But yeah, okay, I can spend a minute showing this more explicitly in general. Well, the reason that the opposite is true, so sorry, if the stress tensor stresses, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's conformal invariance in the sense that there are special conformal generators, but it does mean that there's scale invariance. And that's because the dilatation operator is something like this. The dilatation current, rather. Let me call it, I don't know, d nu. Something like this. Acting with d, by which I mean integral over space of d zero, the charge associated with this current, acting with this on this is the generator of scale transformations. If you like, it's because you know, this, if I put a zero here, then this is like the momentum current. This is like, it's something like T zero mu, right? Which is, I'm not being careful about the index.
this is something like the momentum density, right? Which allow me to write that as x ddx.
Right, so acting on position space eigenstates, this is something like this, which you see. If I have a function which is a power of x, then this thing counts how many powers of x there are. So that's the sense in which this is, that's a sense in which this is the generator of scale transformations. And then the fact that that implies that there's such a generator that's such a symmetry is just the fact that conservation of this current says that this is zero. Because t itself is conserved, right? So the bit where the derivative hits the t goes away, and then what's left just pulls off this thing and contracts these indices. Are you happy?
Can you say that again?
Yeah. Let me just be more explicit. So the statement that this charge is conserved, that is that the Hamiltonian commutes with this operator, is that this current is conserved. Right, this current is whatever the word for this vanishing is. d mu of this current mu is zero. And that's true this derivative is, there's a term where this hits the x mu, and then there's a term where it hits the stress tensor. This is zero just because the stress tensor is conserved, because we're studying a translation invariant system. And so this, this thing is a Kronecker delta. And so what's left is t. And so if this vanishes, this is our assumption, then this vanishes, and so this is conserved. So that's the converse that you were just asking about.
Why is this the scale transformation?
Right, that's what I was trying to argue here. So this is the current. The charge is this. Right, if I have a conserved current, the charge is integral over space of the zero component of the current. And that's this. But this T0 mu is the momentum density. Right? Which an energy momentum density. And so this, that's more or less ddx, right? So just acting on position eigenstates, x is ddx. And so this is something which, x ddx acting on some function of x is equal to nu x to the nu, right? It just counts how many powers there are. Nu is, alpha. Alpha to the nu. Yeah. Okay? There's much rejoicing? Yeah? Okay. All right, so I have one more comment about static equilibrium, which is, so far I've been talking about static equilibrium of thermal equilibrium of a conformal field theory on R3, 1, let's say R3. So where space is just flat space with some cutoff, in some big box. You're still not happy, huh? Okay. All right. But there's another interesting way to put an infrared cutoff on a CFT, which is instead to put it on a sphere, to consider the case where the spatial volume on which you put the field theory is a three sphere. So consider just for a second some CFT, which actually, let's think about in particular n equals 4 Sebring Mills on an S3 times Euclidean time. So this, this thing is this is the thermal circle. That is the compact Euclidean time direction, and so this is space. And the interesting thing about this is that now there are two scales in the problem, right? There's the radius. Let's say this has radius r, and this has radius 1 over t. And so there's two parameters, and so there can be a critical temperature. determined by this radius. And let me make two comments. The first comment is, in this case, you can compute, say, at zero temperature, Casimir energy, that is, how much vacuum energy does it cost to put this quantum field array on this compact space, just by evaluating the stress tensor and keeping track of those extrinsic curvature terms that I mentioned. And in fact, the answer agrees with the free answer. So that's one. This is a calculation by Bell, Subramanian, and Krauss. From 99, which is interesting. And the second comment I wanted to make is that we said that this CFT partition function, well, it's equal to this fancy quantum gravity partition function, and we said we're going to do it by saddle point, right? So that we said that this is something like e to the minus sum of the action evaluated on the saddle point. But in general, such an integral can have more than one saddle point. And in fact, that's the case here. And to see that, let me draw some tents. Let me draw some pictures here. So here's a picture of the ADS black hole. What I mean by this is this direction is the thermal circle. This direction is S3. Oh, so I guess I should say there's a name for the anti-de-Sitter geometry that has spatial sections which are S3. It's called, let me write it here, ADS with space at fixed radius equals S3 is called global ADS. It's called global ADS because it actually is a more complete spacetime. It's the genus of completion of the spacetime that we've been talking about. And there's also a black hole with these boundary conditions, which you might call the global ADS black hole. And it looks like this. So the three sphere has radius r. This direction is the radial direction, which I guess I've been calling z. And the picture of the tent is meant to indicate that as you move in the radial direction, you reach a value of the radius where this circle shrinks, right? But the radius of this S3 does not shrink. This has radius r, and this length is meant to be r, right? So this is meant to be, each of these things is a three sphere. It's not a very good picture of a three sphere, but the thing we're indicating is the size. And this is a circle. Again, the thing we're indicating is the size. And so this ADS, global ADS black hole, is basically you demand at the boundary that it looks like S1 times S3, and then you try to fill in the middle. You try to fill in the middle in such a way that you have constant negative curvature. But there's another way to do that, which is, so this is saddle number one. There's another way to do that, which, as you might guess from the only way you could change this picture, looks something like this, where here again I'm drawing the S1, the thermal circle here. This has radius, at infinity it has radius 1 over tau. This thing again at infinity it should have radius 1 over tau. And this is the S3. At infinity it has radius r. But then notice as you move in the radial direction, the S1 does not shrink here. The S1 stays of finite size, but the S3 shrinks. In this geometry, this space here is, this is the space whose regularity you're demanding by picking the temperature. This space is just, it's basically just in Euclidean section, it's just R2, right? The radial coordinate plays the role of the radius, and this becomes a polar coordinate in R2. And so this geometry has this whole geometry has the topology of R2 times S3. Here, this thing is always a circle. This thing is regular if you pick things correctly, and this space here is, we have a radial coordinate. As you move in that radial coordinate, and S3 shrinks, and so this is just a description of R4 in polar coordinates. This thing here. So this whole thing has the topology of R4 times S1. Well, I guess S1 times R4. It commutes. I just want to write it in the same order. So where you see this is just S1, and topologically, this thing becomes an R4. So these two spacetimes have completely different topology, but they have the same boundary conditions, and they both have nice metrics on them that satisfy the ADS equations of motion, that satisfy these bulk equations of motion, and you can pick them to have exactly the same boundary conditions, so that this radius has this circle has radius 1 over t, and this has radius r in the same here and here, and so these two saddle points compete against each other. So really, this answer is not just e to the minus s of one saddle point. It's really something like e to the minus s of saddle 1 plus, well, times some factors here which aren't going to matter, plus e to the minus s of saddle 2. But now you see, if whichever one of these has the smaller action, because we're exponentiating that action, will be much more important than the other one. Right, so whichever one is more important, you can keep that one and ignore the other one. And an interesting fact, which was discovered by Witten in 9803, is that in fact, as you vary the temperature at fixed radius, there's an exchange of dominance. There's a first order phase transition where you go from a description where the black hole dominates. That's the high temperature description to a phase where this thermal ADS solution, this thing is just called thermal ADS because it's just ADS with periodic identification on the time direction, dominates. And so this fact was discovered in like the early 80s by Hawking and Page, but Witten interpreted this as a deconfinement phase transition in the field theory. So maybe you'll get a chance to understand this better on the homework. So I guess the most important lesson about this is that this is basically irrefutable proof that in quantum gravity you have to sum over topology. You have to sum over the topology of the spacetime, because you see, to reproduce this answer in the field theory, which you know a priori, the existence of this phase transition, you have to include in this sum whatever it was, both of these possibilities, and these two spacetimes have completely different topology. Yes. Right. So let me draw the phase diagram. So temperature as a function of r. So the only special temperature is 1 over the radius of the sphere. At high temperatures, the black hole wins, meaning that the action for the black hole is smaller than the action for thermal ADS. And at low temperatures, the thermal ADS wins. And so this is something that you can check just with the information that I've said so far. Okay. Quantum gravity sums over topology. In case you doubted that, I don't know how many of you might have doubted that. Yes?
Do you think quantum gravity is on the state of string theory?
No. We really know what this field theory is, right? It's something that people are actually have made some progress in putting it on a computer. You can really compute this equilibrium thermodynamics of this field theory. It's something that, you know, you could almost define mathematically. And there's quite a bit of evidence now that this duality is true, that it really is dual to some theory of gravity in this extra dimension. And you're right, we know very little about that. In principle, how to say, if we weren't talking about the n equals 4 theory in particular, if we were talking about some more general quantum field theory, we wouldn't know how to describe it in string theory a priori. But you know, just from information about the field theory and the structure of the duality, this is a demonstration that whatever the dual is, it requires this sum, right, in order to reproduce this phase transition. Now it's true that in the best understood cases, examples of this duality, the dual gravity theory is a string theory. That's true. In string theory, of course, we have very little non-perturbative information. In fact, this is the best non-perturbative information we have. And so a priori, we don't know that you have to sum over topologies in string theory. That's, you know, that's I don't think we have any other in string vacuum and, you know, in higher dimensional string theory, I don't think we have any other evidence for that statement. Yeah, so I guess, when I left out the word this here, I was laboring under the prejudice that a quantum gravity is a valuable and rare thing, that there probably aren't very, very many consistent theories of quantum gravity. So having found one that seems to be working, it's true I was neglecting the possibility that there are many others. Good luck finding them. Yeah. No, I think it's an important question. Okay, so I think this concludes what I wanted to say. Oh, yeah. Okay. So that concludes what I wanted to say about static thermodynamics. But there's quite a bit more to be said here, which is, all right, let me just make a few comments. So far we were talking about space times, which are completely static, where nothing depends on time. But now, a black hole has we do know quite a bit about things that happen as a function of time in the presence of black holes. In particular, the main thing that happens is that stuff falls into the black hole, right? It eats everything that it can eat. And I guess one important ingredient is that excitations above the equilibrium, above this stationary black hole, by which I mean if you throw in a particle or kick the black hole somehow so that it, you know, there's some ripple on the horizon, something like that, some wave in its background, will decay, right? It'll decay back to the stationary case, to the stationary. Right, and this statement is completely uncontroversial. The statement is just that the energy, whatever the energy of the excitation is, it falls behind the horizon, and it's gone. There's just nothing, no way to get it back. And one example of a class of such excitations, a particularly nice sort of basis of modes, if you like, one way in which these things can decay is by what you might call ring down. That is, if I have some particular perturbation of the black hole, I can decompose it in a certain nice basis of modes, which are the quasi-normal modes of the black hole. Quasi-normal modes. And you'll remember that I used this word quasi-normal before. I'm using it in exactly the same sense now, though this word has been used for a long time in the literature on the dynamics of black holes. What I mean by this is that they're modes whose frequency has a non-zero negative imaginary part, which means that their wave functions as a function of time do something like it's e to the minus omega star t, and omega star has some non-zero imaginary part with the right sign so that this is damped. So that is to say, it's a mode that decays with some characteristic damping rate, which usually just it's 1 over t, more or less. I guess that's worth saying, that the damping rate is something like 1 over t, with some pi's maybe. And so this comes just by studying wave equations in the presence of the black hole. And so but the important point here is just the very presence of the horizon in the system means that there's a source of dissipation. which for people studying quantum field theory and trying to study, for example, real-time dynamics of a quantum field theory in equilibrium, the introduction of some source of dissipation is some real horror, in the sense that you have to somehow either explicitly introduce a heat bath, you have to, or maybe introduce some kind of some sort of static disorder, or something that can take away the energy of the excitations, so that the system is able to relax to equilibrium. And so, a wonderful aspect of this description of equilibrium quantum field theory is that this dissipation, the source of dissipation, is just built in from the very beginning. It's just part of the leading order approximation, just from the fact that stuff falls into the horizon. So this is actually a pretty powerful aspect of this business. Okay, and so next I'm going to talk about a little bit about what happens if we make some small perturbation of this thermoequilibrium, ask about some particular dissipative transport coefficient. But I guess I should mention that, in fact, you might this general idea that the approach to equilibrium in the dual field theory is described in such a system by the evolution towards the stationary black hole, that is gravitational collapse. This general idea actually has also been studied in other cases, and in particular in situations where one begins in some situation very far from thermal equilibrium, like say the vacuum with some objects coming at each other, and in fact it's possible, and people have worked very hard to do this, to watch the black holes in the bulk form, by numerical computation, and this is a description of the approach to thermal equilibrium in the field theory. Okay, so this is something that with a little cleverness you can do on a laptop. Just by solving these gravity equations, but it describes this really horrific thing of like a heavy ion collision, maybe, from the point of view of the field theory. Oh wow! They're doing numerical relativity in ADS.
I'm not sure about ADS, but collision of black holes and stuff, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you should ask them to try to do ADS. It's a little bit different than numerical relativity in flat space. So I guess I should say that the expert on the people who have done the most to progress this subject are Paul Chesler and Larry Yaffe. So if you want to read more about this, I recommend looking at their papers very strongly. So this is on the subject of numerical relativity, and in particular, black hole formation from various initial conditions which attempt to mimic heavy ion collisions in ADS. Okay. So back to slightly less ambitious things. Yeah, that's maybe okay. Okay. Yeah, all right. Yeah, let's take a couple minutes break. Good. It's 11:35, I see. Okay. 5 minutes? I have a lot.